This is Radio Westenberg for Breezio. You ever find yourself wondering if we're making any social progress? You know, in our ideas about race or gender. And it's hard to measure, but clearly we must be moving forward, right? Well, the writer Peggy Orenstein says, for boys, for young men, when it comes to what it means to be a man, that idea, she says, is not moving forward. It's stuck, or worse than stuck. In her new book, Orenstein says the ideal for being a man seems to be contracting. And this is completely different, by the way, to the experience of what it means to be a woman. Orenstein has spent a lot of time writing about young women. Her book, Girls and Sex, was a bestseller. And she says feminism gave girls an alternative to conventional femininity. But boys, they don't have anything like that. So they're left with these unrealistic or dated expectations about how they're supposed to deal with relationships and their own feelings. A few years ago, Orenstein started talking to boys, like she had to girls, and she was surprised by how much they opened up to her. Her new book is full of stories, like this one about Cole, which is, by the way, not his real name.
You know, I just didn't think he would speak. He was sitting outside of a library in his school, and I was kind of running late, and I was running down the hall. And I see this guy who just looks like the stereotype of the jockey boy. He's white, he's big. His hands are on his knees, which are kind of splayed. And his neck seems to go right into his jawline. And he's got this totally impassive expression on his face. He just did not look like the kind of guy who would talk to somebody about me, let alone talk to me about his sex life and feelings about intimacy.
But as you say, he surprised you.
He did surprise me. He pulled out a picture of his girlfriend, who he said was a feminist and who had taught him so much and who he had such high regard for. And then he started talking a lot about his struggles around ideals of masculinity. So he was saying, you know, that you got to be a bro. And whenever he would say bro, he would kind of lean back in his chair and talk from kind of the back of his throat like he'd inhaled a lungful of weed. It was like, bro. And I pointed out that he would do that, and he just burst out laughing. And he said, yeah, because, like, a bro is always, you know, a bro's athletic, and a bro is simultaneously aggressive and chill. It was kind of a little encapsulated image of the idealized guy that he felt that he ought to be whenever he leaned back and did that versus the person that he really was.
He had this remarkable presence of mind, this awareness of the various cultures that he was part of or going to be part of. And then also, he used the term social currency.
Yeah. You know, we've talked a lot about this whole locker room talk situation. And he and a friend went up against a guy who was saying, let's just say, something despicable about women. And the other boys mocked them. So Cole said the next time somebody said something, his friend stepped up, but Cole stayed silent. And he said he watched as time went on, as his friend continued to step up. And he said, as he continued to step up and I continued to step back, the other guys started to like him less, and he lost all his social currency. They stopped listening to him. And here I had buckets of it left, but I wasn't spending it. And he was going into the military, and he said, and I don't know what to do. I don't want to have to choose between my dignity and these guys that I'm going to serve with. How do I make it so I don't have to choose? He really looked pained. You know, we talk a lot about the sort of aggressive talk or weaponized talk that boys might engage in, but for so many boys, they don't want to do that, and they don't approve of that, but they don't know how to stand up or band together to challenge it. It's in that silence and what they can't say and what they don't say and what they won't say that they learn the rules of masculinity.
Peggy Orenstein's book is called Boys and Sex. You've spent a long time writing about, of course, the lives of girls. And you say in the book that you never actually imagined that you'd write about boys. But
nope.
But something changed. Explain what brought you to this point.
Well, I've been writing about girls for 25 years, and I published Girls and Sex, which was about the contradictions that young women still face in their intimate encounters. And I was going around the country talking about that book, and everywhere I went, parents, girls, sometimes boys themselves said, you only had half a conversation. When are you going to write about boys? And I thought, well, somebody should do that. Yeah, somebody, not me. But the truth was that nobody was doing it. You know, nobody was talking to boys. Nobody was listening to boys. And as I was sort of thinking about all that, the Me Too allegations started. Mm-hmm. And suddenly the breadth and scope of sexual misconduct across every sector of society became so glaringly apparent. And there was this imperative that we reduce sexual violence. But to me, I also thought, in kind of thinking about talking to boys, that it was this amazing opportunity to engage them, maybe for the first time, in discussion about sex, about intimacy, about gender power dynamics, and about masculinity. So that got me really interested, because I thought, we've got to know what's going on in their heads. We have to now, because we have to, you know, help guide them so that they can make the best choices.
It's interesting. One of the things that you seem to ask every one of these young men that you talk to was, tell me the ideal guy.
Yeah.
Why that question? What is it that you figured you'd get from that particular question?
I guess I wanted to know how that question would differ from who they thought they were. Hmm. And the ideal guy, I mean, I've heard this put in different ways too. A friend of mine in Maine said that who does sex education said that he likes to say to guys, okay, so I'm a robot and I want to fit in with boys. What do I need to do, you know, what traits do I need to have in order to pass for a human boy?
Right, right.
And you know, in so many ways, guys were, you know, have changed. Things have changed for them. They see girls as, you know, deserving of their place in the classroom and in leadership and on the playing field and professional opportunities. And they're having these overarching conversations about consent, at least to some degree. And yet when I would ask them that question, what's the ideal guy? It was like they were channeling 1955. You know, would say, it was like dominance, aggression, sexual conquest,
and stoicism.
Stoicism was the big one. Emotional suppression. That was the big one. And it was just sort of that same old, you know, you can call it the man box or the mask you live in or whatever you want to call it. They were still really struggling with that. And I felt like, you know, I really reflected a lot on my work with girls, because when I first started writing about girls in whenever it was, you know, the 90s, girls were living with this sort of newly understood and really tense contradiction of all the new ideals that they were supposed to be striving for. And all these, you know, standing up and shining bright and being who you want to be and doing what you want to do. But we hadn't really let go of all those old ideals about being deferential, pleasing people, you know, defining yourself through your body, all these different things. And it was really hurting girls. And I think that we have done a lot towards, if not totally fixing everything, you know, we've made progress and surfaced the issues and we're talking about them. And I feel like that's where we are with boys right now, that we're at this point where we realize there are things that are untenable about the old ideals that they still cling to in a world that has new expectations of them that they want too. And we have to start talking about how those things, and then you have, you know, like this overlay of this huge media edifice, how we help boys navigate through that so that they can have the be the kinds of people and have the kinds of relationships that we want them to have and that they want to have.
You point out that feminism gave young women an alternative. Like they had this conventional view they had to live up to. Feminism had them gave them a way out. But young men don't have the same kind of alternative, it seems.
Right. And when you look at research on, you know, on how girls see being a girl and how boys see being a boy, again, girls will say, there's lots of ways to be a girl now. And, you know, from being very unpopular for a while, feminism is really popular with girls again. They embrace it. And boys, however, still see this very narrow idea of what it means to be a man. And I will say that, you know, it's not just coming from the media. It's not just coming from their peers. But they say in one survey, 60% of them said those rigid ideas about masculinity came from their parents.
Yeah.
And particularly from their dads.
It seems like that's a theme, and we'll actually get back to that a little bit more. But the idea of having conversations with young men about this stuff—we're just not. We're not talking with them, and we're not listening to them. You say.
Yep. Absolutely true. And whether it's about masculinity or about gender dynamics in relationships, or whether it's about positive, pleasurable ideas about sex. We're not. And especially where sex is concerned, what boys would always say to me was, you know, what my parents said was, don't get a girl pregnant, don't get a disease, and respect women. They got told to respect women a lot. Hmm. But they were like, well, what does that mean?
Right.
And one guy said, you know, my favorite quote on that was a boy who said, well, that's like telling somebody not to run over any little old ladies and then handing them the car keys. I mean, Of course you think you're not going to run over any little old ladies, but you don't know how to drive.
It's interesting, and this surprised me, I have to say, because it seems like we're making all this social progress in our attitudes about gender and sexuality. But you say that idea, when it comes to being masculine and this idea of masculinity, you say that idea, in fact, isn't moving forward and may even be contracting.
Yeah. There's actually a narrowing that when you look at research that talks about how boys see masculinity, they are less likely than they used to be to see traits that we used to ascribe to masculinity, though they don't have to be masculine, like leadership or integrity, as being how they see masculinity. It's just not part of it. So it's sort of been a chipping away to kind of this most narrow idea. And, you know, I guess I feel like sometimes you don't know what a book is about until after it comes out.
Hmm.
And I feel like with this book, whether you're talking about ideals about masculinity or about sex or about relationships or any of this, so much of it for boys comes back to the not being able to express emotional vulnerability.
Yeah.
And the taboo against that and wrestling with that and deciding whether, you know, capitulating to it or embracing it or rejecting it or deflecting it or all these different things. And the ways that when you're not allowed, when that emotional suppression piece is still there, it not only undermines your humanity, but it makes it – I mean, Brené Brown, the sociologist, talks about emotional vulnerability as the secret sauce for, you know, that keeps relationships together. So – It undermines their ability to attain and maintain the kinds of relationships we want, and then that radiates outward to harm not only themselves, but potentially their romantic partners as well.
Well, you write about the consequences of all of this sort of stoicism and suppression, you know, that they're more likely, young men are more likely to engage in binge drinking and risky sexual behavior. They're more likely to get into, you know, car accidents, higher rates of depression, have fewer friends. It seems like even more isolation.
Yeah. Boys who more strongly hold to those kinds of masculine norms. Yeah, there are rewards, right? I mean, you can see in our culture that you can get rewards from staying in that, you know, the man box, if you want to call it that.
Yeah.
But there are also huge costs to themselves and to others around them.
I want to ask you about, while we're on the subject of emotional vulnerability, let's talk a little bit about Rob. Rob is a young man you talked to who had broken up with his longtime girlfriend. They'd been together for, I think, 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And it hit him really hard.
Yeah.
Though he couldn't publicly admit it. And there wasn't really any anywhere he could turn for comfort, because that was the role his girlfriend played. She was the one he turned to for comfort. Talk a little bit about this, because his inability to be vulnerable, to actually just have a good cry, was really fascinating, this part.
Yeah, so he – I mean, and he talked a lot about his dad, how his dad had told him to man up and suck it up. And I do want to say that there were those boys, but more boys would say – you know, there was a shift in the culture, obviously, and they would say, my dad was not sexist. My dad was not homophobic. He did not, you know, teach me that toxic masculinity. But I did learn that more – that stunted side of masculinity for him. He, you know, didn't express emotion, and he was more of a sigh and walk away kind of guy than somebody who would ask you what was going on. So, you know, there, it wasn't just – the guy, the fathers like Rob's who had this sort of, you know, man up, don't be a little bee kind of attitude. But Rob had learned that. And he – so when his girlfriend, his high school – he was a freshman in college. His high school girlfriend inevitably cheated on him. And he kind of snapped his fingers and said, so I just forgot about her. But he didn't. Yeah. He spiraled into what would objectively be called a depression, where he wasn't, you know, his schoolwork suffered. He didn't want to go out anymore. He lost his enthusiasm for everything. And so he and he tried to go to therapy at school, to a counselor, but he said it was too weird to talk about feelings. And he just felt like he should be able to handle it. He should be able to handle it. And so then he goes home, and it's Thanksgiving break, and he has what he called a breakdown in front of his mom. Who, you know, sort of says, okay, spill it. What's going on?
Yeah.
And he does talk to his mom, and that helps. I also thought a lot about how boys will often, if they're going to confide in somebody, they'll confide in their mom. And I actually think that helped them talk to me, because I look like their moms.
Right.
Or a therapist, depending on your perspective.
Yeah.
But the thing is, and I think it feels really good to mothers of boys to see them be vulnerable, to be able to be there for your son. Of course, that feels great. But I worried a little bit in hearing those stories that when we process boys' emotions for them rather than helping them process them for themselves, that we play into this idea that they learn that women are there to do the emotional labor of men. And then that not only leaves them ill-equipped for – again, for adult relationships, but I think a lot of women know that that doesn't feel as good when when you're doing it with an adult man as it might doing it with your son. So it's important just to kind of contemplate that. But to Rob's story, so I asked him, if he had cried crying was a big thing with boys talking to me about whether they cried, if they cried, how they never cried. And it took me a while to kind of get it because
You said they saw it as a rare and humiliating event.
Yeah. And to me, you know, again, woman here.
Yeah.
So I saw it as something you do, sometimes. And so I learned to really listen to what boys were saying when they talked about, you know, what felt to them as like a loss of control or a sign of weakness by crying. And times when they couldn't and wanted to. One of the boys that I talked to, his parents got divorced, and he was a never crier. So he streamed 3 movies about the Holocaust back to back so that he could cry and have that release. That worked.
Wow. You know, you write this in the book. You said, an inability to acknowledge any human frailty was so poignant it made me want to...
Cry.
Yeah,
it did. That inability to be able to express that frailty, that vulnerability, that, you know, boys learn so often from the get-go, they grow up in a kind of more impoverished emotional environment than girls. Mm. So mothers, fathers use less emotional language with babies regardless, but mothers tend to use a broader, richer emotional language with infant girls than they do with infant boys. And with boys, we tend to – the emotions that we tend to stress beyond happiness is anger. And so they tend to learn that whole bucket of emotions of sadness, of grief, of loss, of frustration, of disappointment, you know, betrayal, anything, all that funnels into anger. And it's really important with our boys, especially little boys, if you have little boys, to start working on broadening their emotional vocabulary and naming those emotions or noticing, you know, when your little boy expresses anger, maybe stepping back and thinking, like, what is going on underneath that? Is this anger or is this sadness or fear or disappointment? And can you name that? You know, can you say that must be really disappointing, or it seems like you're feeling afraid right now? Or helping them know what those feelings are and be able to name them is really important in keeping boys connected to that, to their deeper selves, and creating resilience and the ability to be in a, you know, a relationship in the way that they want to be in.
Well, you also point out that, you know, it's odd that boys end up in this impoverished emotional landscape when there's actual evidence that infant boys may be more expressive than baby girls, at least early on.
And then
you say by age five, there's studies that show little boys learn to kind of disconnect from feelings of weakness, or to kind of ditch the idea of being friends with girls. There's this kind of
underground. Yeah. It goes underground. Mm. Yeah, and they recognize that sort of hierarchical behavior is how you be a boy. And actually, I just read something a couple days ago that came out that said that by four, not at three, but at four, boys associate power with masculinity and femininity with weakness.
Wow.
So that's there really, 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 really early.
But it's not natural. That's a cultural thing, right?
That's a cultural thing. Yeah. Yeah. So we can interrupt that. That's the good news.
Yeah.
We can interrupt that. We can call it out. I mean, one of the things that I talk about in terms of media is that I think with girls, again, I've been doing this for 25 years with girls, we have recognized much more powerfully that the messages that girls get from the media are potentially harmful to them, that the messages that reduce them to their bodies, you know, the sexualization, objectification, that is really harmful to girls' body image, to their self-esteem, to their cognition, to their mental health. And as parents and activists and advocates and therapists, we have done such a better job of helping our daughters. It's not perfect, but helping them develop a lens so that they can see how those messages are trying to manipulate them. And we don't do that with boys. We let them grow up in the same stew, and sometimes the temperature is higher. And we never really challenge the images or ideas that they're absorbing from that.
I was surprised that it hasn't always been this way, because one of the things you mentioned is the history of masculinity is different. Like in the 19th century, the ideal of masculinity looked somewhat different than it does today.
Yeah, yeah. I talked to Andrew Smiler about that, who does that research. And the ideal of masculinity was, you know, you could cry, you expressed love for your male friends, you wrote poetry.
Yeah.
You know, it changes. It's always changed.
Peggy Orenstein. Her new book is Boys and Sex, Young Men on Hookups, Love, Porn, Consent, and Navigating the New Masculinity. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
What happens when a Mormon, a Muslim, and a rabbi walk into a bar? Join us at the Preach Podcast live show to find out. Special guests include comedian Stacey Harkey from JK Studios, co-founders of The Emerald Project, and a millennial rabbi. Plus, live music and limited edition Preach swag. Preach Podcast Live is January 30th at the State Room in Salt Lake City. Tickets and info at preachpod.org/live.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, Peggy Orenstein is joining us. A few years ago, she wrote the book Girls and Sex, where she explored the high-pressure sexual landscape young women have to navigate every day. But a few years ago, she realized that was only half the story. In her new book, she says young men are stuck with many of the same cultural forces and expectations that girls are. But girls have feminism to give them an outlet and an alternative. Boys don't have anything like it. The book is called Boys and Sex. You mention in the book how your biggest fear when you started all of this was that boys wouldn't talk to you.
Yeah.
But man, that is not how it turned out to
that
be.
That is not how it turned out.
It's so interesting that people were getting in touch with you. Boys, young men were getting in touch with you to say, please interview me.
Uh-huh.
Which
yeah.
doesn't sound like a thing a boy would do.
No, it happened all the time. And that did not happen so much when I was talking to girls. So it was interesting to me. There were two things about that. One was boys, like if I would be on a radio show like this and some boy would write to me after listening to the show. Say, would you please interview me? I have things to say. They had something to tell me about something, some aspect of what I was talking about. And the other thing was that I mean, I got the guys that I talked to in all kinds of different ways, and I had a network kind of established from doing the Girl Book of teachers and college campuses where I could do work. But because I was simultaneously going around and talking about the Girl Book in different places in the country and parent groups and stuff, and I would mention that I was now going to be doing a book on boys. Afterwards, and this never happened with girls, never, parents of boys would give me their son's phone numbers, their emails. They'd say, would you please interview my son? And I sometimes felt like people were flinging boys at me. And I think it was because we know that nobody talks to boys. And I think that they were hoping that in addition to interviewing them, that maybe it would be an educational experience as well.
So one of the things you mentioned is that with some of the boys you talked to, they treated your conversations as these kind of protected spaces.
Mm-hmm.
Explain that. What was the relationship? How do you describe or explain the relationship that you established with them?
Well, you know, I just – and I learned this from doing the girls' book. When I first started doing the girls' book and talking to girls, I would betray shock, surprise – my face probably looked super judgmental. Early on, they would just never speak to me again. They would disappear.
Yeah.
You know, they ghosted me. They wouldn't return texts. They wouldn't return emails. And so I had to really learn how to come to the work with openness and curiosity and lack of judgment and ask them questions and just let them say what they were going to say. And hear whatever it was that they wanted to say and sometimes, you know, pick up on something and go, wait. You know, I was talking to one boy who wanted to talk to me about his pornography use. That was kind of the main thing he wanted to talk about. And then somehow I said, so when did you first have intercourse? And he kind of looked up at the ceiling like he was trying to remember. And then he said, Friday. I said, wait, what? Because it was Tuesday,
yeah.
You know? And so there was this whole other story that just hearing that, I was like, wait, I think I need you to tell me that story too, my friend, that yielded a whole different thing. So as part of it was, you know, it's that active listening and also just creating a space and giving them permission and saying, you know, whatever you say here is okay. And bearing witness to that, I think, meant a lot to a lot of the boys that I talked with.
What difference did it make that you were a woman?
So I wondered that a lot.
Yeah.
And of course, I can't say
right.
exactly because I can't do it over again as a guy.
Yeah.
But I worried that they would not be frank or blunt or raw with me or tell me real stuff because I was a woman. That did not turn out to be the case. Mm-hmm. And, you know, FCC prevents me from talking about that. But the book is pretty blunt.
Yeah.
And I would also try different things like having them I would have boys interview their friends when I wasn't there, like friends who didn't know me and see how that worked. Or I would have girls interview boys, or I would have boys interview their brothers. I would just try different techniques to see what would yield the most interesting or seemingly, you know, authentic kinds of discussions. And I didn't find there was that much, you know, I found that it was fine with me, but also that maybe for everything, I ended up feeling that it was kind of an advantage and that they could, because again, if boys are going to talk to somebody, it's going to be a woman.
Yeah.
You know, that's who they're going to confide in. So they could drop that pose and maybe for everything, I mean, I think they might have talked to a more, you know, a certain kind of guy, but I felt that for everything that they maybe possibly didn't tell me because I was a woman, they told me something for that very reason.
Yeah. You know, this was really interesting to me that these young men would talk to you about almost anything. They'd talk about premature ejaculation. They'd talk about their porn use, about erectile dysfunction. But one of the things they didn't really want to talk about was how it is they talked in the locker
room. Yeah.
What was that about?
I know. Well, because they knew that it wasn't about – that what that was about in a kind of deep way. They wouldn't have put it this way, but it's about heterosexual guys bonding over and proving themselves as heterosexual by bragging about controlling women's bodies.
Yeah.
And it's weaponized.
Yeah.
It's a weaponized discussion. So, you know, how do they talk? They hammer, they nail, they bang, they pound, they
yep.
hit that, they tap.
Yep.
You know, it's like they went to a construction site,
mm-hmm.
right? It's not like an act of intimacy. And so, again, it wasn't like boys were blank slates, and they struggled with that. And I've had boys since the book has come out who have emailed me or one who – a Division I athlete who came up to me at a reading I was doing and said – I'm really, you know, I heard you talk about that, and what do I do? You know, how do I disrupt that? Because I don't like it. And I think there's a lot of guys, you know, who are sitting there thinking, ugh, this jerk again, and thinking, you know, what is my role? What is my responsibility? What is the likelihood that this is going to go, that this is something that isn't just talk, but that is, you know, creating an environment where men will treat women badly? You know, so they were trying to figure it out. And again, they needed adults in their lives to start engaging on those conversations.
Yeah. Can I mention a word here that's part of the conversation? And I guess two words here that are going to require some warning for those listening. Cole told you, for example, that his friends didn't say the N-word. They didn't say the anti-gay slur. But they could say pussy or bitch.
Mm-hmm.
That was allowed.
Yeah.
What did you make of that?
Well, I asked him, you know, why is that okay? And
yeah.
he said, well, you know, he rode crew, and he said, well, you know, somehow if somebody says, you know, don't be a pussy, Cole, pull, that really bites. And I said, well, what, you know, and saying like, don't be weak, pull, that wouldn't bite as hard. And I said, well, what do you mean bites?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he said, well, I don't really know. And I said, well, why do you think it's okay to say these words and not those other words, which you recognize as being slurs and detrimental? Mm-hmm. And he said, well, I know it's not really okay, and I just kind of don't want to think about it that hard. But I did pay a lot of attention to how guys used homophobic slurs.
Yeah.
I mean, that was super interesting, because one thing that had changed was that a lot of the straight guys that I talked to had gay friends, gay
yeah.
male friends,
yeah.
good friends. And they would say, I would never say that to a gay person. That would be offensive.
Right.
So that's good. So it's okay to call your straight friends that F word, but not your gay friends. That's interesting. And what it really was about for them, and they knew that wasn't, you know, and by the time they got into college, they were doing it less.
For sure.
But what that was about was policing masculinity. Mm. It wasn't about sexuality. And, you know, it was you could say those words draw the lines of the man box. And the threat of being called those names is what keeps you inside and keeps you from challenging. And C.J. Pascoe, who's a sociologist in Oregon who does a lot of work around those words, did a whole thing. She looked at 1,000 tweets with the hashtag NoHomo.
Mm-hmm.
And what she found was that guys would – yes, it was a homophobic slur. Yes, it was a joke. But it was also a shield that heterosexual guys used in order to express just like basic human emotion
yeah.
of affection and connection. So they'd say, you know, to another guy, hey, haven't seen you in a while. We should hang out, dude. Hashtag no homo.
It's so fascinating, because you said that – as a way to actually express true emotion with other young men, they're using this term as a kind of an – I think this is how you put it in the book, or maybe the sociologist did – an inoculation against the insults.
Yeah. I think of it as a deflective shield,
right?
Yeah, or an inoculation, something that allows you to say what you mean without getting targeted or marginalized or seeming to be challenging ideas about masculinity.
Let's talk about the subject that you say is probably the most crucial aspect of at least toxic masculinity, and that's this idea of sexual conquest, which brings us to the story of Nate that you tell in the book. Let's talk a little bit about him to illustrate
Nate.
This. It's so funny. Every time I mention a name, Peggy, you have this kind of fond – you do think of them as kind of – as your boys in some ways, don't you?
I do. And I kind of joke that if my 16-year-old self knew how much time I spent texting of course, my 16-year-old self wouldn't have known what texting was. But, you know, texting teenage boys, she would be shocked. I do stand – I mean, Nate is somebody that I really do stay in touch with more than most.
Well, let's talk about Nate, because Nate is kind of – he's afraid of his – he's worried about his skills in the bedroom, afraid of intimacy.
But measuring them through this idea of, you know, kind of hookup status. Yeah. And what he says is, you know, a hookup is – it's you're doing it to impress your guys. It's not about what happens in the room. It's about the story you're going to bring back.
Yeah.
So maybe you're going to be a little dominating. Maybe you're going to push, because the girl is just – what he said is the girl's a means to get off and to brag to your guys. So he's going along trying to figure this out, and he ends up in I kind of tease him now because I say, so your worst hookup of your life memorialized in print for all time.
Right.
How does that feel?
Right.
But it was this, you know, this moment. There's, you know, he talks about this whole, like, guy's ideas about the need for experience and what experience means, and being able to knock out your firsts regardless of how you really feel about it. And he was really a boy who – wanted and prized connection and relationships and deep thinking and discussion, and was kind of being pushed into this other kind of behavior because that was what was expected and that was how you kind of proved your status as a boy. And it goes badly for him. And he ends up in a hookup where, you know, one of the things boys would say, when I was working on the girl book, we talked a lot, the girls and I, about why – about the role of female pleasure in a hookup, which – because the orgasm gap in hookups is so big, and it gets smaller in relationships. And, you know, and what did that mean? And and guys would say that in a hookup they didn't really care, to be honest, that male pleasure was assumed. And if – you know, if that happened for girls, that was nice. But but what it turned out when I talked to the boys that was interesting was that they did care about female satisfaction. They just didn't measure it that way. They measured it as about stamina in intercourse. They measured it as about genital size, things like that. And so one boy had said to me that he would look at the clock before he would start intercourse in a hookup so that he would know that he had, you know, done a sufficient job so that – the girl in question, he's like, it's not even about her pleasure. It's about her, what she's going to, again, the story in the room, the invisible audience. And I want her to be able to go back and tell her friend she wasn't disappointed so that I don't feel shame. And so Nate got shamed.
Yeah.
And so I kind of narrate this whole experience of his arc of how he looked at hookup culture, how that didn't serve him, how he got shamed, and how he sort of moves through it to something better. And then really the final piece of his scene was his story was that I was actually Skyping with another boy, Wyatt, who had been very big into his college hookup scene but had kind of been coming to terms with the idea that he was a very feminist-minded boy, very egalitarian, but that he realized that while he said all the right things in those encounters, that in fact he was taking advantage of a gender skew on campus that advantaged boys and kind of manipulating girls and treating partners as disposable. So what he said and what he did was not always in alignment.
Yeah.
And he was thinking about that. And Nate texts me because he's down visiting a college that he was admitted to. And he's like, hookup culture, I can't say this again on the radio, but let's just say hookup culture is crazy down here. I don't know what to do. What should I do? And so Wyatt, I read the text to Wyatt, and they ended up having this conversation through me, which is one of these sort of moments as a journalist you can never predict.
Yeah.
But it was about authenticity and about not giving into the conventional script and about other possibilities. And then Nate texted me and said, you know, thank you. That it was just what I needed to hear. And he sent me a heart emoji. And, and I thought about, you know, I sat with that and I thought, I'm a stranger. These boys are strangers to one another. They will never meet. But what if they could have these conversations with people that they knew? You know, what if they could have them with other guys? What if they could have them with adults? And that was really what I hoped to provide with this book, was some tools or some fodder, I guess, for that discussion with adults and boys, and maybe for boys themselves to be able to get past the guy talk and open up a more meaningful conversation with one another.
Well, you write that masculinity is not just about what boys say, but often what they don't or won't or just can't. say.
Right, right. And so, you know, how do we help them recognize that when they're sitting in that isolation of thinking, you know, I'm not sure I like this, I'm not sure this is what I want, I'm not sure, I don't like, you know, what if I would like to speak up, but what if I do? How can we connect them so that they can have those conversations together?
What effect do you figure pornography is having on their sort of, not just their erotic imaginations, but their sense of masculinity? I mean, the idea mm-hmm. that women exist primarily as providers of a male orgasm, that's what yeah. porn is about. And the men, as you point out in the book, is, you know, they're mostly sort of joyless and mechanical. What kind of influence, as far as you right. can tell, is all of that having on their experience of sex?
Well, so kids right now are kind of in the middle of a big porn experiment, and we don't really know fully what the impact is going to be. But but I think it's important to understand what's changed and why we don't have the luxury of being silent around it. And, you know, obviously curiosity about sex is normal, and exploring your body is super important. But what's changed is that with first smartphones and the internet, but not just that, it was that in 2007, Pornhub dropped the paywall on hardcore porn. And so suddenly you could get anything that used to be behind, you didn't used to be able to get at, you know, at your fingertips 24/7.
Yeah.
And so the guys that I talked to, I never said, do you look at, you know, I never asked whether they looked at porn. That was not the question. It was when, because
yeah, that would have killed your that
would have killed my credibility.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there was not a boy,
right.
not a boy, who hadn't been looking at that. And it, as you said, it shows the kind of porn that they have the easiest free access to. Over and over, reinforces that idea of sex is something that men do to women. You know, female pleasure as a performance for male desire. You know, weird bodies, activities, even in the more vanilla clips that really wouldn't feel good to a lot of people, and particularly to a lot of women. And when we're not talking to our kids about what a mutually gratifying, pleasurable, you know, personally fulfilling relationship is, that's the de facto sex educator. And they're not learning it in school. They're not talking to their parents, and we're not talking to them
yeah.
about what they're seeing. And I know that you'd rather poke yourself in the eye with a fork than talk to your son about his porn use. You know, I'm not – it's – but we can't not do it anymore. And we have to talk to them about what's real and what's not real and what's, you know, what's missing because they – we know, you know, how media works. How media works is that it, even when you think it's not affecting you, it does. That's why, you know, the Russians invaded Facebook, because they know that – repeating things and saying things and exposure colors our beliefs and our thoughts and our behaviors. Mm-hmm. So they were, you know, bringing those ideas into the bedroom, into what they thought ought to be. And meanwhile, girls, when they looked at porn, tended to look at it as an instruction manual for what yeah. guys wanted. Mm-hmm. So then there's two people walking into that room with completely skewed ideas, thinking this is what the other person wants. And they have to, and that doesn't mean they don't get beyond it. I mean, obviously most people do, But, you know, I always thought with kids, girls and boys, that I don't want their early experiences to be something they have to get over.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you a little bit more about bro culture. Mm-hmm. How did these young men talk about sports? Because it's interesting how many seemed unwilling to deal with the intense bro culture of organized sports.
Yeah, I was really surprised by how many guys I talked to who had quit sports, not because they weren't good at it, not because they didn't like it, but because they just couldn't stand that culture of the team.
Yeah.
And at the most extreme end, one of the guys that I talked to had been recruited to a small college and to play sports, and he just felt so offended by the way the guys talked and that the coach talked that way too, that mm-hmm. the coach was like reinforcing it, and he saw no way of making change there. So he not only dropped out of the sport, but because he was in a small school and he didn't feel that he could escape that in the social environment, he transferred.
Hmm.
So it could go pretty far. And I do think, you know, sports, obviously, you know, they can be fun. They can build character and teamwork and all of those things. And they can be a smokescreen for that worst type of bro culture and misogyny and us against them attitude and homophobia. But I also think, and I've seen in programs like Coaching Boys into Men, which is a kind of light intervention that coaches do with high school and middle school athletes, that those all-male enclaves can also be leveraged to be crucibles of change. Mm. So I actually really have hope that you know, under the right circumstances, they can be places that break down some of these ideas rather than places that build and reinforce them.
There's this educator that you mentioned, Charis Dennison,
mm-hmm.
who I have to say had my favorite quote in the book, probably.
I know, me too.
Let me read it. At one time or another, every young man will get a letter of admission to Dick School. The question is, will he drop out, graduate, or go for an advanced degree?
Right. And so what we're trying to create here are Dick School dropouts.
Yes. So is there a moment when a parent or a teacher can head this off, can step in at that moment when the young boy is, you know, is getting that letter of admission? Like, it seems like there's an opportunity here.
There is tremendous opportunity. And, it's not one talk.
Yeah.
That would be kind of like if I sat you down and said, okay, table manners. This is how you use your knife and fork, and don't burp at the table, and say please and thank you, and use your napkin, and say excuse me, and okay, go forth. Now you know your table manners.
Right.
You know, doesn't work like that. And in Boys and Sex, what I did sort of at the end, which I didn't do in Girls and Sex, and I don't tend to do in my books, because when you're a writer, the first maxim that you learn is show, not tell.
Mm-hmm.
So I always operated under the assumption that what I should do is show the reader, you know, a situation or a person or a classroom where things are working the way that I would promote them working, you know, a sex ed classroom or something.
Yeah.
But I just felt like after 9 years of writing about kids and sex that I had some stuff to say.
Yeah.
And so I sort of stepped out from behind the curtain on this one. And I give a series of ideas, not mm-hmm. scripts, because I can't really give you a script, but types of conversations that you can have with your boy, and many of them work with girls too, that are, you know, just moments here and there, just dropping it in.
Broadening the masculine repertoire is one thing.
Broadening the repertoire, yeah, yeah. Whether it's broadening emotional repertoire, questioning the media that they're consuming or helping them look at it with a more critical lens, talking about consent but not just about consent, talking about sex but not just about sex, making power dynamics visible, talking about, you know, examples of people taking personal accountability. I list some of those in the book that you can watch or read or listen to. It's just a series of small things, and particularly I want to mobilize the power of adult men in boys' lives, and I know that it's not how most guys were parented. It's not what they learned to do. But boys really expressed a desire to hear from the men in their lives around these issues, around sex, around the emotional aspects of sex, around regret. And I think that what men need to know is that you don't have to be perfect. You don't have to do it right the first time. You don't have to know all the answers or all the questions even. Or have a perfect relationship yourself. You just have to start somewhere. You know, you just have to say, we haven't had these conversations, and I'm realizing that we need to. And on my website, which is peggyornstein.com, I have resources for parents who want to broaden these conversations with their daughters and with their sons, ideas for, you know, for books and videos and all kinds of conversation starters that you can employ.
One thing that you mentioned in the book is that as you were doing all of this, you sensed what you describe as a deep desire among these young men for something different. So
yeah.
they're at this time when they know this isn't working, or they know this isn't right, and they want to do something different. I mean, that also seems like an opportunity.
Yeah. I mean, the really exciting thing about this work was really seeing the opportunity. And I've kind of moved off, like, even using that phrase toxic masculinity. I've replaced it with sociologists say precarious masculinity, which I think is a little less demonizing. But partly because I saw how much many of the boys that I talked to wanted more guidance, wanted to be able to challenge some of these scripts, wanted to be able to challenge some of these ideas, whether it was that sort of man box idea or whether it was hookup culture. They wanted more guidance on, you know, on love. They wanted more guidance on connection. They wanted to understand, what their media and porn use meant more. All these things, they really wanted to grapple with and understand this. And that's why I said, I think, you know, we're at this point where we may have been with girls when I first started working on girls, which is a turning point, an inflection point, where boys themselves are saying, look, you know, the way boys have been raised, not working for us. And we need something new, and you know, we need the guidance to get there. So it's an exciting opportunity. It's an exciting moment.
Peggy Orenstein, thank you very much for taking the time.
Thanks. This was great fun.
Peggy Orenstein. Her new book is Boys and Sex. A version of the story appears in this month's issue of The Atlantic. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter, at Radio West. Our intern is Natu Twe. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard, by Ali Vallarta, and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.